Since most of you don't know me from a gooseberry, I imagine I should tell you my name is Leo Busted. I'm a sheep herder in Pullman, Washington. And Pullman isn't very big. It isn't the end of the world, but you can see it from there. And half the people are gone from Pullman today. The ones that aren't here are being humbled in Manhattan, Kansas. If you call 2 points being humbled.
Oh, yeah.
And perhaps a little... Well, I have more than a passing interest in the field of nutrition and feeding and all. I learned what true hunger was, not by the day or week, but by many weeks and months as a prisoner of war. And I have studied, I have done advanced study in the field of nutrition. But there are many here probably today who are more qualified than I to discuss this subject. But I'm here, and for the next few minutes, I am going to discuss it. The background for this is probably best described by two incidents. When I left the remarkable presentation by Fritz Norstedt here this morning at about 11:46, I went charging back to Chalet 3, where we were meeting in a session of the Science and Technology Committee. And we had a report due by two people who were scheduled to be there then, so I was hurrying there. I was stopped by one of our young lovelies, a very keen and concerned young lady at the bulletin board. And she says, "I see that you are going to discuss world hunger." I says, "I will be discussing world hunger along with some other subjects of how we feed all the people, not only in the world, but in this country, and what we're doing about it here at Holden Village." And she said, "Could you give me a thumbnail sketch of it? Can we feed everybody?" And I was in a hurry, and I was quite short with her, and I said, under the present circumstances, in the time and framework of the year 2000 or so, we cannot. She says, "Even if we are not selfish," I says, "perhaps if we are not, if selfishness includes not controlling our population, or if we are become unselfish and control our population, then maybe we got a chance." The other reason that I will be discussing the subjects that I will be today is that in our Science and Technology Committee, which we will be reporting on at 6:45 tonight, one of our concerns is conservation and addressing the food situation and in our own home. And when we sent out the minutes from this meeting, one of the Science and Technology Committee members who is not here sent me a letter with some very good additions. One of them, however, concerned me, and it was this: cut down on the use of meat and replace them with other vegetable proteins. For every 10 pounds of beef, about 100 pounds of grain are required as feed. The more efficient use of the grain would be to eat it directly. Therefore, in a hungry world, we need to convert more towards a vegetarian diet. I will also address that subject. I don't happen to fully agree with it. All right, now let's start with population. Most of you know this, but it's well to put it in the framework here so we'll have a point of a common point of departure. It took millions of years, perhaps, to reach 1 billion people on Earth. And that occurred in 1830. It took only 100 years to reach 1930 with another billion. And then it took us 30 years to reach another billion, 15 years to reach another billion, and probably within 10 years from today, or maybe less, we will have yet another billion. And before the year 2000, there will be another billion. And so it goes. Now, to put it in real perspective, there will be 80 million increased this year. 80 million people to feed this year. Or today, by the stroke of midnight, 220,000 people. That gives you some dimension. Now, what if we control population? What if we say we're going to have zero growth, 2.1% increase? Starting now, will that level out the population? It will not. Why will it not? I will only use one illustration to make the point, but it applies in many other places. But in Mexico right now, 48% of the population is below the age of 15. If you have zero population growth there starting now, which is impossible, you will have, and that is a 2.1% increase. It will probably be 75 years before the population levels off. In other words, you're going to increase because of the population constituency, that is age, the age bracket that it involves in the percentage of each. So that is a real concern. A realist recently remarked that some problems do not have solutions, only consequences. The world population food problem is one of them. The surging world population is pushing man in many places to the limits of his adaptability. Now, what is the prospect? The prospect of feeding the world adequately is hopeless in the present population situation. We cannot continue to have exponential growth of the population. That is, it's doubling every so many years. And I've already told you about some of the consequences because of the makeup of the population. Another problem is that today there are only really two countries that are contributing to the deficiency of the world food supply, and that's the United States and Canada. And there will be an increasing demand on our food supplies because many of the other countries are becoming wealthier and are paying well for him, for our excess or surplus food, among them Japan, whose intake, for example, of meat has increased, 200 and some percent in the recent past. So they will be bidding for this, and so we cannot really meet the demand. The other problem is that we have, if we're going to face the issue in underdeveloped countries, we should increase then their production. And there's a lot of effort being directed towards that with only limited success. And part of the problem is that you can go ahead and probably increase the production somewhat, but it's very costly in many respects because it takes a high input of hydrocarbon fuels. Because we have developed remarkable grains, cereal grains in recent past, and they're programmed to require a very high input of hydrocarbon fuels and a lot of water. And this is very costly, and it was developed on the basis that hydrocarbon fuels are going to be cheap. And they are no longer cheap, nor are they going to be in great supply. The other problem has to do with management and waste. And countries such as India do not know how to manage the distribution or the waste. Some of us in the Science and Technology Committee just an hour or two ago, we were discussing this. And Dave Larson pointed out that, you know, we think of the great waste we have in this country, which is probably 15%. In India, for example, the waste of food there, that is, the food is here, and the amount of that that never gets to the consumer, it varies between 35 and 50%. Part of it is their method of distribution. There's 8 rats for every Indian, and there's a lot of Indians. And then the cows, a lot of the ruminants, which are sacred, eat quite a bit, but they never eat them. So that's a very big problem. So religion, their religion does enter into this very much. So we have this thing of purchasing power, which is very limited. The other thing that tensions will be developing as more people come into the world, the third world will demand more from industrial nations. And there will be more starving people. There will be limited supplies of food. And there will be great problems that result. We do not know how many people have to be dying from famine in a given country before there is great unrest. I do not like to be here when that experiment is conducted. Now, so to go to the next point, I will say that the enormous population experience, or this expansion in population, is really a unique human experience. We have not really entered it until the very recent past. And its implication for human welfare is very profound. Of special concern here is the danger that the increased pressure for food will undermine our soil resources. And this is part of the point of my discussion today. It's something that I've been harping on for quite a while. Because in many discussions, they're always saying, well, look at all you can get out of cereal grain versus the animal. And my contention is that intensive agriculture that is required today in the production of many of our cereal crops is undermining a very fragile resource called soil. And you had a remarkable expose relative to soil and Mother Earth this morning. The loss of soil is a result of intensive agriculture and row crop cultivation is a critical issue that few people have really addressed. In this regard, I am reminded of what two people, one fellow named Jack, that was his last name, and the other named White, spelled W-H-Y-T-E, said in their book, Vanishing Lands, which was written in 1939. Hear their words. Below that thin layer comprising the delicate organism known as soil is a planet as lifeless as the moon. There isn't much of it. And when it's gone, we're in trouble. Now, where are we relative to this? There's been a recent study on this, several recent studies. In fact, the most recent one appeared in as the lead article in Science magazine within the very recent past. And they reported on a study in Wisconsin of five areas, and where there was intensive agriculture, chiefly corn, but soybeans and I guess a few other things. And the results of their study showed that there was a loss of 2 to 25 tons of soil per acre per year. In the majority of the area sampled, the estimated average soil losses were more than twice the amounts that are considered compatible with permanent agriculture. More than twice. There was a study in Tennessee that was even more disturbing. The average erosion rate based on all cropland was 9 tons per acre per year. For upland soils, there was 19 tons per year. Erosion had increased mainly because of the rise in soybean production. In a study in Iowa, the estimated average annual soil loss for the unprotected slope cropland in the state was 13 tons per acre per year. And this is about 2 bushels of soil for every bushel of corn produced. In another part of Iowa, in 1974, during a disastrous erosion period, the soil losses were 40 to 50 tons per acre in many places. Now, that's a lot more than two times what is compatible with permanent production. And there's something that must be done about this. Leopold, in 1966, in a probably little red journal called Sand County Almanac, he addressed the subject of the land ethic. And he said, "We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. There is no other way for land to survive the impact of mechanized man. The land ethic demands a harmonious balance between nature and all the works of man. Systemic cultivation in the public mind in this critical period of an ethical sense of man's relationship to the soil would facilitate the conservation of cropland, which has now become more vulnerable to destruction than ever before." And I can take you to our own county where Pullman is located. In Whitman County, we raise more wheat than any other county in the world. Beautiful rolling hills, some of them very steep. And I'm sure the loss of soil is probably exceeds many of these. And the production has really gone down. There was better conservation measures in 1941 than there is now. And this cannot last. If you fly over it next summer, early spring, you'll see many bare areas, especially on the top of the hills. This is a very serious problem. At this point, looking at the world population problem and this limited ability to really meet the world's needs, cause one to identify with Dr. Astroff in the play Uncle Vanya. It's by Chekhov. Dr. Astroff is a physician, and he questions the course of the march of progress with these words: "If factories and schools had taken the place of devastated forests and tired forage, then people would have become better educated and healthier and richer. But nothing of the sort has happened. We have the same swamps and mosquitoes, the same disease and want, the typhoid, the diphtheria. We are confronted by the degradation of our country, brought on by the fierce struggle for existence by the human race. It is the consequence of starving, shivering, sick humanity that to save the children it instinctively snatches at everything that can warm it and still its hunger. So it destroys everything it can lay its hands on without a thought for the morrow. And almost everything is gone, and nothing has been created to take its place." One almost has to reach that conclusion. Now, let us look at what we can do. Well, how do we address the issue raised here by one of our science members, who says cut the use of meat and replace them with vegetable protein? Every 10 pounds of beef, about 100 pounds of grain are required as feed. A more efficient use of grain would eat it directly. I'm going to address a few of those subjects now. And I will say things that you may disagree with, and you'll have plenty of chance, I hope, to take care of this, because I'd like to finish this within the next few minutes so that we can have some time for discussion. I want to remind you that probably 60% of the land mass of the world is fit only for grazing and production of plants, not fit for the diet of people. Now that's over half. There is very little potential for increasing significantly the quantity of crop land for the world now. most of it's been pretty well taken care of. Productivity of much of the world's grazing land, however, could be significantly increased with probably not too much input. Some estimates are from 3 to 5 times. Increased yields of cereal crops, however, would require heavy inputs of energy, which is now about 80 pounds of gasoline, I guess, or petroleum per acre. Maybe it's higher than that. Some of you may know. This fact dictates utilizing the world's huge cellulose resource through animals. Plants produce principally two things, starch and cellulose. Cellulose exceeds the starch production. We can eat the starch, but we don't do well on cellulose, although the fiber does help in our nutrition, although it doesn't offer any calories of any consequence. The production of digestible nutrients for human consumption per acre of much of the world's cropland is significantly greater if you go through the forage ruminant systems of land use compared to direct production of food crops. Furthermore, significantly less energy is required in forage ruminant systems than for production of many of the food crops.
Leo, will you explain the forage ruminant system?
Yes. In other words, you go to the grasses, which we can't eat, through a ruminant. And by ruminant, I mean a ruminant-like animal that has an ability to digest cellulose. And they're not all so-called four-stomached animals that many of you know so well. It's the sheep and the goat and the cow that most of you know well, and maybe the deer and some of the wild ruminants, but there are other animals who have some properties like this, and there's quite a large number of them, who can do quite well on what we can't eat. In fact, some of the lamb you eat, and also probably some of the beef you eat, may have never had any input of cereal grain in them at all. That's the advantage, of course, of sheep, because there's a low energy input. The other aspect of it you must realize, and it's a serious question that we point out, that many people have been led astray. With cereal grains, you get a one for one. As I told my associates earlier today, when I eat my oatmeal every morning, to get that oatmeal, to get 100 pounds of oatmeal, it took 270 pounds of oats. The 170 pounds that wasn't in my oatmeal is only suitable for the ruminant, or for a cellulose eating, and it makes a very good food for them. There is a pound or more of plant parts, principally cellulose, that is usable for ruminants for every pound of corn, rice, or wheat that's produced. And somebody has estimated that if only 5% of the total waste cellulose material could be used for animal feed, it would provide the dietary energy required to produce all the world's protein needs through ruminants. That'll blow your mind.
Can you say that again?
Yes. It has been estimated that if only 5% of the total waste cellulose material today could be used for animal feed, it would provide the dietary energy required to produce all of the world's protein needs through ruminants. There's another advantage of ruminants, is that they are capable of using non-protein nitrogen to fulfill part of the protein needs, and thus complement, of course, the nutritional requirements of people. They can eat, for example, ruminants can use urea, which you can't use. So, there are some real advantages. Now, there are also some problems. But I should point out that they're a source of not only red meat, but they're also leather, many drugs, insulin, for example. And milk is dairy products are the single most important source of protein in the U.S. diet. Taken together, beef and dairy products supply about half the protein of the U.S. human diet. Beef and dairy products supply 33% of the total energy intake, 50% of the fat, 80% of the calcium, 62% of the phosphorus, and significant quantities of minerals and vitamins. Now that's making a case for the ruminant. Now some of you can point out, but You know, we eat too much meat. And that's what this person who wrote me the letter said. And that's true. We probably only need, we're eating probably close to 100 grams of meat or protein a day. We probably only need 25 or 30. We have a poor grading system for beef. Many people feel that in order to have real tender, juicy beef, you have to have a lot of marbling and a lot of fat. And that's a snare and a delusion, because I have eaten and you have eaten probably quite a bit of beef, especially in earlier times, that was older, but it had little fat on it at all, probably very little marbling, but it was very tasty and very juicy. And if you go to Alaska and have moose burgers, there isn't much fat on a moose, but it's pretty juicy and it's mighty tasty. What do we need to do then? We should cut down, I think remarkably, on the amount of fat that we put on an animal. What do? We put on all this fat, which is very expensive. It isn't 100 to 10. It's worse than that, probably, of the amount of grain you have to put in to get the pound of fat. What do? With it? You trim it off and throw it away. And that's a pretty expensive throwaway. I'll clue you in. We cannot afford to do that. But what we should be doing is developing animals that have a better potential. Now, in this regard, it's an area that I have more than a passing interest. I am and we can improve and increase our production of livestock. There's much more data I could give you here, but I want to get to discussing this. There are a few figures, though, that I do wish to give you. The animals constitute a very important stockpile right now of both food and capital for the world, especially in the developing countries. The total caloric worth of the worldwide animal stocks within the last few years was 50% more than that of the grain stocks, and the animal stocks were more evenly distributed. However, disease is a very great problem. In this country, we lose by disease probably $5 billion worth of livestock a year. Now, that's pretty impressive. The rest of the world, it's far greater. And this is a very great waste. So we should be looking at ways of what can we do about this? Well, we can... We can certainly work towards reducing the incidence of disease. And we have a lot of the tools ready for us, but there's hardly any money for research for food animals. I've spent most of my life in researching animals, but all of it essentially directed for work on animals, for extrapolation, for application to people. And I've spent millions of dollars of your money for this, and some of it was worthwhile for you. Very little money is set aside to look at the disease of animals, and even less in foreign countries. So that is a great potential. The other thing, there's a great potential for improving the level of the livestock, the value of the livestock. And I'm reminded of just my meeting last Wednesday in a conference room in a new State Department in Washington, D.C. I met with some officials from the Agency for International Development, called AID. They have spent very little in the animal end of things. And some people from USDA and many places. There were about 20 people there. I and a fellow named Dr. Wyszynski and a person from Battelle made a presentation in the area of embryo transplant. One of the great things that happened in increasing the productivity of livestock was artificial insemination. Now we have reached the technology where we can take a very good cow, we can hyperovulate her, we can get not one calf per year from her, but we could probably get several eggs every month.
and we can then, well, they're fertilized, she's hyperovulated, fertilized. They are then removed. Until recently it was surgically done. Now it can be done non-surgically. And we can then place it into a receptive female. Some of them are in heat. Enough of them are in heat when you harvest the eggs, you see. You can now freeze them. Part of our interest in this goes back to many years ago. We as a country have shipped a lot of livestock to foreign countries. We have very good livestock in this country. We ship them to foreign countries. And what happens to them? Well, in many cases, they die because they're not resistant to the diseases of that country. One of our proposals back about 3-4 years ago was for AID to sponsor this. We were then, before we ever had frozen embryos, we were going to preserve the embryo. We can do it for 24. We've been working on to get it to 48, 72 hours. Then you could fly from, say, SeaTac to almost any part of the world, well, some principal centers. And they'd have their indigenous cattle all lined up, you see, and then you'd go zing, zing, zing with this, you see. And then the offspring would have a better chance because they would have a native mother, and then she would nurse this offspring, and they'd have a better chance to resist the disease. I'd also like to go the other way to get some of the probably good stock from some parts of the country that might be better to utilize the grasses. The poorer forages without so much input, or also work on developing various strains that may, with some grain input, just a little grain input, are returning not 1 for 8 input, but 1 to 1, or approaching that, and I think that is a possibility. But the other aspects of this are very exciting to us. As we're looking, as my associates are very competent in the field of immunology, to pick out the very good ones. And I can take you to some farms in Skagit and Snohomish County, where there are certain farmers that have really outstanding livestock. And they're hardy Holstein cows that never are sick, they never have reproduction problems, hardly ever. They produce a lot of milk for a long period of time. And we've already had a remarkable increase on production of milk, and it can go up even more. And I won't give you any of those figures, but they're exceedingly impressive. But if you can take some of these cows, some of these very select ones, and then hyperovulate them and get frozen embryos, the potential is exceedingly great. You can get there in a hurry, in other words, instead of waiting, get one a year. It takes a long time to get there, but we have the potential to go that route, which is very exciting. There are other things we can do, which some of you can bring up in the discussion, which we're going to open up now, or almost now. And part of this, of course, going more to ruminants, and a special type of ruminant, does also address part of this problem of the intensive agriculture. Because we cannot go along as we have with this intensive agriculture, especially on sloping hills, can we? We have to put in rows, perhaps, in the top of the hills with more permanent pastures. So you have a crop there, like the legumes and others, that hold the moisture and hold the soil, and that can be used to feed ruminants. Now that cuts down the production. When I talked to a good friend of mine who's a very enlightened farmer, when I first came back to the Palouse country in Whitman County after I'd been in California for 8 years, just 4 years ago, I sort of gave him old Ned. There's also another expression which you probably more you understand, but I got after him. And I said, you got the conservation award. I remember many, many years ago because of your conservation methods. And I says, the conditions of these soils out here, they're far worse than they were 20 or 30 years ago. And he says, well, the price structuring of the government and others have forced us into this. So there's a lot of things we have to do about this, but I know one thing for sure. We can't keep doing what we're doing, or our children will condemn us, and rightfully so. Now, to bring it here to Holden, what is the philosophy here? We have a nutrition group within our Science and Technology Committee who are here to help the people in the kitchen who are doing such an exemplary job here. And I've seen it change over the years from 1963 when I came, and now this is 45 times later, or maybe it's 46 or 7, I've lost count, but I've been here quite a few times and I've made a lot of observations. And what we're moving towards, and the problem in America is not a scarcity so much, although there are some, there's real malnutrition in America. And there is hunger in America. But the biggest problem in nutrition in America is there's too much. We eat too much. So part of the, I guess the push here is to not only have the food tasty, to cut down on the amount of dessert, but to have it nutritious. And you'll notice we bake our own bread, we get wheat is given to us, and we grind that and have some remarkable bread. And we're moving in that direction. We are also suggesting means of conservation in many areas, which we will discuss later tonight. Today, right now we're talking about nutrition. And some of the recommendations that this particular person who wrote to me said, don't preheat ovens. Now, these are kind of things we're making up as a packet to go to congregations. Don't preheat ovens. Turn them off early and use residual heat to finish the baking. Plan meals to fill the oven completely rather than just cooking a single small item. Another area there, if you have an oven, these microwaves, although they're expensive, they use less heat, of course. They're faster. And on preheat ovens, I've done an experiment. I told my associates about it earlier today. And I often work in my office late, and sometimes I always have some of these frozen pies and stuff, and I have a very small oven. And it always says preheat the oven to 440 degrees. They don't taste any worse if you don't preheat. I found that out, and believe me. That's right. So that's a good recommendation. In like manner, use residual heat to finish cooking food on stoves. But my wife, I call her the chief, she says, it doesn't work on gas burners. Give up using dishwashers, or use them only when they are full of dishes or when large quantity of dishes need to be washed. Might cause some fear. Learn to utilize leftovers. We try to do that here too. And they do better than I'm able to do. All right, now I'll first call on my associates in the Science Technology Committee, and which includes you, Dorothy, to have any corrections, additions, or whatever it might be, to what I have said, and then we'll open it up for general discussion.
Will?
Yes.
You did a nice job of feeding the ruminants, but what would be the EPA input to all this output?
Yes. And I'll tell you something about that. You know, what goes in the front end has to come up to the other end, is what he's saying. And reutilization and recycling of animal waste will cause revolutionary increases in the efficiency of animal production without significantly reducing the value of animal waste or fertilizers. Calculations show that cattle currently in feedlots would provide the supplemental protein for 120 million laying hens. And this is about a quarter of our of the population of the U.S. in chickens. And in turn, the droppings from hens would provide protein for 4 million feedlot cattle. Now, I don't know how long you can continue that. the other aspect of this is that, and I'm not taking this lightly, Mark's question, which is a very important one, because this waste is a real problem, but it's also very important, probably, for the soil, to put this back in the soil. And I think that's probably one of the things you have in mind, because organic matter is a lot of what we lose. And it can be then substitute for many of our commercial fertilizers to an extent, using more nitrogen-fixing plants and going that route.
I got one other comment.
Yes, sir.
You indicated that there was several billions of dollars lost due to disease in the animals. How much of this loss is aesthetic rather than actual?
Yeah, I couldn't give you a percentage on that. There's been a good deal of calculation on what is the loss of disease. It isn't too hard to calculate the animals that die, the calves that die that never grow up, or the ones that are condemned at the packing plant. That's pretty easy to calculate. What is more difficult to calculate is that when an animal is sick and it recovers, its efficiency in feed utilization is remarkably decreased in many cases. They never really do well. And if you really costed it out, you should have hit them in the head. And that's a soft figure. And it's probably the larger figure. Larger figure. Now, as to appearance, we could probably utilize a lot more things if we eat a lot more things if we, we're used to them.
Yeah, that's what I was asking, is how much of this wastage, that is now wastage, could be actually utilized, and we'd be none the worse for it. In fact, we'd be better from the standpoint of having it available.
Yeah, you see, people, it's very hard to change their views. And, for example, a lot of people say, well, you don't really need any meat. We can really develop better quality protein. We can develop good quality protein in plants. See, that's one of the problems through the years. And sources, for example, of B12 from the animal. And the quality of protein, in many cases, from plants up until the recent past, was a problem in human nutrition. It's been improved some. For example, high lysine corn was developed, and they were going to really fix up South America, where they didn't have all that much meat, so they were going to give them high lysine corn. And they didn't like the high lysine corn. But it's just like when I served on the Food and Food Protection Committee of the National Academy of Sciences, we'd look at things like the problems come up to them like, should you add saccharin to things? Should you add food additives? What other hazards are this? About the cyclamate? And sometimes industry representatives would appear before our committee. And some of them had done extensive studies, realizing that Cokes are not the way to go. Cokes and hamburgers do not make for a balanced diet. Now, most people don't know that. They know it, they don't believe it. But Cokes are all the soft drinks. When I get to be dictator, no more.
Only hard stuff.
Aquavit. No. They realize this. And what they tried to do was sort of develop a high protein or a soft drink like Gatorade, only with even more punch protein-wise, And they tried it instead of this country. A lot of people try it in other countries. And they tried this out in, I think, Brazil and some of the countries. No go. They wouldn't buy it. They wanted Coke because they had been introduced to Coke. Rot your teeth, mess up your GI tract, get you addicted. You know, that's what people want, isn't it? You can't tell people what they need to know because they want to know something else. And the trouble is, it isn't that people don't know anything. The trouble is that most of what they know ain't true. These are just two of my 18 laws. A third one is, there is no complex problem, which if looked at in the proper way, doesn't become more complex. And that's the problem we're discussing today.
Leo, how long can you hyperovulate these cows?
That's a critical issue, and that we're not fully sure of this because some of them don't really respond that well, and we have to have a better titering of the products we're using. And also, I should also say that the developments are continuing in this regard. Some of them do give out, but we can get more than what we've been getting now. For example, the development of prostaglandin.
Mm.
Now we can, we can, for example, instead of having 500 cows out there waiting to come and heat, we can probably do it with maybe 75 or 100 cows. You do a lot with that, and you can use prostaglandin and inject with prostaglandin and bring them into heat, which is kind of a neat trick.
And you literally meant frozen embryo.
Yeah, frozen over. We haven't done very well at this. And what our plea was, part of my sell job to AID was, look at you, turkey. And I didn't use those words. I said that right now, I mean, we could have really, if you would have, if they interpreted right, they would have said, now, if you guys would have given us the money in 74 and 5, we'd be well along on this. But you don't like, you didn't do this. Now, in Canada, there's something about industry that's kind of private industry that people rebel against, unfortunately. But Canada was wise. Canadian government gave some money up here in Alberta and to a couple other places that were heavy into embryo transplant. And they associated with the university. It was kind of a combined thing, government, university, industry, which is a nice combination if you behave yourself and work together. And what they did, and they shipped a guy from Cambridge in, and they were the ones now. They got them. They got a lot of calves on the ground from frozen embryos. They really have, and they're getting about a 30% on them. 30%, which is pretty good for frozen embryos at this stage of the process, and they couldn't do it 2 years ago. And so that's truly remarkable, and it can be increased. And if we go to non-surgical, then that's remarkable. Of course, this isn't a new kind of a thing. It was in 1897 that they first did the first embryo transplant. It was in England. They did it on two different kinds of rabbits, the Angora into a short-haired one, and it was legitimate. And then they got excited about it, I'll tell you, when what stimulated it in the recent past was when they had all these exotic beef breeds that were very expensive and limited export to this country. And everybody was hot for limousines, and that's the name of a breed of cow. And other exotic breeds, you see, boy, they were really gung-ho for them. And so they brought a very high price. And so they could afford to do embryo transplants surgically. They could stimulate, get out some eggs and out of these and do it. Now, right now, in the Holstein breed, like Dr. Wyszynski in Stanwood, Washington, he is doing some of this on surgical. Just the other day, Dr. Ellison went out to this fellow and he had this cow and he said, boy, I want to get this. So he goes non-surgically in, takes out a fertilized egg and separated out in this little wiley head. Then he and his technician, they crawled over three fences and
got the recipient cow and took care of it surgically, and he was on his way.
An unhappy bull.
Yeah, I have a... That usually goes back to Arthur's insemination. I have a fly I sometimes show. And what it is, it's a fellow running across a field at high lope. He's carrying a little suitcase that has AI on it, which is artificial insemination. And the reason he's running so fast, he's being pursued by a mad bull. Well, that's another thing we're, of course, interested in. I should point out, I told these people some other things. Some very exciting things. Because one of them is in vitro fertilization and growth for a while. That's doing it in vitro, meaning in glass, in the test tube in a laboratory. And another thing is to sex them. If you could sex the sperm, that'd be really great. And also test viability of the embryo, and we're working on that. The other thing is, if you let the fertilized egg develop, say, into the eight cell stage, and then separate out each of those cells, so you got eight of them, put them into eight different cows, you'd have eight similar offspring. I mean, they'd be similar twins. And in a very recent past, and I don't know what species it is, he's supposed to tell me. You know, when the sperm and ova get together, we have what we call the pearl nucleus. And somebody went in and destroyed one of the nucleus. One pearl nucleus, so there's only one left. The stimulator, that's the divide. It went haploid and then diploid. And the stimulator, that's the develop then. So it's really from one parent or the other. And that has great potential if you could go ahead then and say you only get the female, then you know you're going to have all heifers. Well, you can't go on like that forever. But quite a while.
I have a question.
Yes.
I was wondering, first of all, do they use hormone-stimulated hyperovulation? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, is there any problem involved there with the offspring, like, you know, when they were using DES on women and the children were coming up with cancer? Is there any problem?
No. Are there any other veterinarians here? I guess I can speak authoritatively. Of course, you usually don't keep the cow around as long as people. Being economic situation. I remember the oldest cow I know was named Dolly, and she was 17. And that isn't really the potential for them. To my knowledge, there has been no reports of that. In fact, the uterine cancers are very low incidence in the bovine.
And those are totally different hormones.
Yes, they are different hormones. Yes.
Seems like I'm listening to you. You put an awful lot of hope and perhaps even faith in technology. And it seems like a lot of the reaction in society has been that technology, instead of being the answer, has been the problem. Would you care to remark to that complaint?
Yes, I would. Many of our problems are due to results of improper use of technology and some of the devastation that has resulted. But what we are given is what we have now, and we got to go from here. And if we resorted right now to an agrarian existence like they did a long time ago, you'd have to make the choice of who's going to live, and there'd be you'd have to choose the millions that are going to die because you're not going to have enough to feed them.
I
You are making us cognizant of this problem on food. So we have a problem with energy and fuel. But we as people of the United States, isn't it our big problem that as long as we elected a lot of idiots back there in Washington who will not face a problem because they're only worried about their job and they think that the American public isn't able to recognize or want to cope with the problem?
Yes. You have addressed a significant issue. Because long-term planning, by definition, under our system of government, it's on a 2-year, 4-year, 6-year, or at the most 8-year cycle. Because that's long-term planning, because that's most of the elected positions' tenure. And we have to plan ahead further than that. And we face this issue now in energy, which you have pointed out. And they are exceedingly concerned about this. We have, on 2 occasions, had here in the village, Mike McCormick, who is a congressman from this area, who is probably the best informed elected official, probably anywhere in the world. The best informed, probably, on the energy situation. Because he is scientifically trained, and he has addressed his issue and spent, and he works very hard, night and day, and he has a very good staff, and that's a key to the success of any congressman, on addressing this issue. And I'm sure that one of his concerns, as there is for many in Washington, is that if we should suddenly say we're going to cut the import of gasoline or of crude oil right now, which will cut it almost in half, won't it?
Oh, yes.
All right. So if you do that, where is Detroit going to be? The number of people unemployed in this country will be phenomenal. And their concern is how many people need to be unemployed in this country before you have a change in government. That is a real, real concern. And it probably has good basis.
All right, you raised one question then. What about, I've only read this in magazines, about the scientists they can utilize grain and mix it with imported oil and produce gasoline. Now, I've read this, and then they say, well, this is all well and good, but the petroleum people don't like it. Well, then, now, this is what I can't understand. If we could produce, say, 40% more and deduce 30% from Arabia,
yeah. Yeah, we'll address some of this, I think, in our next session at 6:45, and it also addresses part of your problem. And that has to do, and it is, we face a very uncertain future, but also a very exciting one. And in miniature, it's sort of here at Holden, because we are looking at this situation. How do we get off hydrocarbon fuel? There's a lot of possibilities. There are some very exciting possibilities. You mentioned, we can get wood alcohol right now. If we added 10 to 15% wood alcohol into our gas tank, it would certainly would improve things. It would be less hazardous as an exhaust. The motor would probably run as well, if not better. You get better mileage, and you wouldn't be using that much hydrocarbon fuel. Wood alcohol can be made from renewable resource, from wood and other things. Some other people, pardon? Well, it just takes them a while to get going. No, I don't think that's the case right now. I think it's partially economic. My associates on the Science Technology Committee can address that. Part of it is economic.
Before we leave, Mr. Taylor, we're getting
Talk a little louder. Can you all hear him back there? This is Dr. Metz.
More into some of these energy problems, perhaps later in the scientific committee report, but I would like to make one just short comment on the question that was raised here about technology.
I was going to ask you for that.
And I do think Leo answered the right way, and I think the gentleman who pressed this left might even agree. A lot of people say that the problem is technology. I don't really think they mean that. I think they mean the problem is, or there is a danger in the misapplication of technology. And the reason I want to mention it is, I'd like to ask people what their definition of technology is. And really, I think there's only one answer. Technology is know-how. In other words, technology is the means in which we apply our basic knowledge that comes out of research to our applications of the things we produce. So clearly there can be nothing wrong with know-how with technology. That's how we get our standard of living. It is the misapplication that is a problem, and it's a very difficult one to answer, and the scientists don't always know, or the technologists. They are trying to bring out applications. In a way, you can't just assign all of the blame to the people who developed the know-how in the youth. I think we all have to jointly be responsible and take a position in that youth and be heard.
Now, the bell is rung if you're hungry. You don't insult me if you leave. If you want to stay and talk for a little while, I'll stay here. Yes?
So you think it's more of the ivory tower technology. Like, you know, you've got all these marvelous solutions you've been telling us about. But we're still getting USDA prime and choice meat, and every chicken you buy has a handful of fat in the middle. So somehow you're getting together.
And that a lot of that is polemic, and I have not been party to some of the discussion, but I have been a listener to some of the discussions about this, and part of that relates to the economics of it, that that there is a point of diminishing returns.
Due to technical problems, there is a gap of undetermined length here in the tape. The discussion continues.
I heard an interesting talk on that subject, and this fellow was really outlining the steps in the program and all, and with many complicated factors, such as it's out in the mountains, and the only people who live there like to live there because it's lonely, and if you're going to start processing it, you're going to bring whole cities in, because the people that are going to dig for this and work with it don't like to live out there all alone and all those problems. But then he said the crowning blow was, we went out and started doing air pollution studies to have a baseline, and the air already is more polluted than the government will allow their oil from the coal to produce. And he says, the air is already more polluted than the government says it can be for us to do it. So he says, what in the world can we do this?
There are problems.
Well, in 1960, I remember in the Shipping Port Reactor, this was long before EPA or a present nuclear regulatory agency or anything else, but the regulations then required that they put the water back into the river at a lower radiation level than they took it out. And we've been in that bind, you know, for decades.
I have a question about food supply. You talk about the market crops this year, all the publicity that you read, magazines and books, and et cetera, talk about the diminishing world's food supply. We're down to, 15 days surplus of food, survival. And then all of a sudden this year, we see the scraping bumper crop. When we have this excess in bumper crop this year, does that all get sold to foreign markets? Or is there somebody, is the government buying it to fill up our surplus again? What happens to that bumper crop? Are the farmers who heard on that, so they wouldn't want to have that happen again?
I'll take a first crack at that, and I have discussed it to an extent with Senator Magnuson's staff and a little bit with Foley's staff. So Foley is a congressman from the state of Washington. He's also
chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, and it has been debated in Congress as to what extent the government should become involved in building up the storage, having government storage and buying up the grain. And the farmers, many of the farmers and agricultural organizations resist this from the standpoint that this is how they control the price. And they've had some very sad experiences with it because it's many years they didn't make anything. They lost money. They're losing money now. And so they question the intentions of the government relative to this as to how they're going to use this. So that's why it's a hotly debated point. Some others here may have more knowledge of this than I, and I want you to speak up. I would like to see that we do build a substantial supply of some of these cereal grains. We're looking at that also here at Holden. And the reason is that with the increasing population we have, and we're going to have some bad years. Who can say about what we can have another Dust Bowl? We know that in studying history of temperatures and all, that there seems to be some indication of cycles. And if we entered here in the state of Washington, if we don't get very much rain and snow this year, and if California doesn't get some, well, that's a disaster. And if we got, and there were some areas in the Southwest, and you've gone through it in Minnesota in the last year and all. I mean, things were tough. Well, what if that was expanded, where we really were in trouble? A lot of other than people than us are in trouble. So that's why I believe in some kind of a storage system. Does somebody else want to address this?
Is there anything being done, my question? Do you believe is the government actually doing that? I really want to talk about this doomsday stuff. You know, they say, this is bad, the food supply is going down.
Yeah, well, there isn't. They must have some idea of the amount of storage. Right. A lot of the farmers and a lot of the grain growers associations, they got a lot of stuff full right now. Because, you know, why sell it for a loss? If you got enough storage capacity, you're going to save it. Remember when the price of grain went up here, went up to $5 or $6? I know a farmer out there. He was farming between 2,000 and 3,000 acres. He hadn't even sold a year before his crop yet. He had it all in storage, and the price went up to $5 or $6.
A related
cleaned up. Pardon?
A related question. There's a really changing cold temperature that the hybrids could no longer produce under a colder climate. That's it.
Well, some of them are more sensitive to this. They're not as hardy. They're not as hardy also for disease, and the disease could wipe them out. That's one of the reasons. That they have to keep, one reason to keep developing those that are resistant to certain diseases, and you have to keep moving in this direction. But I'd like to hear Dr. Halverson on this. To what extent do you or someone here know to what extent of what percentage or what bushel capacity is the government storing grain now? Or other people.
There are good figures on it. I don't happen to know, but there are good figures on that in this country. We know quite closely how much we've got, what the storage capacity is, what percentage is being held by farmers on farms, what's held in commercial storage, and so on.
Yeah.
I simply don't have the figures in mind right now.
But it isn't a year's supply.
Right now we've got, if we didn't get a kernel of wheat next year, we have enough wheat in this country to supply us for 2 full years.
Here we say, right?
Yeah. We've got, we use about 600 million bushels of wheat domestically a year. The crop this year was over 2 billion bushels. And there was some in storage. The total wheat reserve on in supply right now is quite a bit over 2 billion bushels. Normally, some of this is sold. So if you subtract out what is normally sold in the world trade, we would still have more than enough wheat for 1 year in this country. And the crop of corn this year is one, it isn't the biggest, but it's one of the biggest that we've ever had. It's right around 6 billion bushels.
Go ahead.
We have a tremendous reserve of grains, wheat grains and food grains. We've got about as big a surplus of rice in this country as we've ever had. And by the way, we're one of the big, world's big exporters of rice.
See, and what I want to point out here is that the values he's given is for our consumption in this country. Now, when you put that in the world situation, and if the disaster is there, you know, it's a different ballgame, number one. The other thing that's very critical is this. I guess it was 1971 was probably the first time that our balance of ship of trade went negative since 1894 or something. It went to 2 billion, and then the next year, 72, it went to 6 billion, and it's very substantial now. In other words, we're spending more money than we're taking in as far as export trade goes. Now, what can you do about this? Well, you can ship out labor, or compete in labor market with our labor. You immediately realize that our labor costs are higher than most anywhere in the world. So that is not a feasible way to address the balance payment. Number two, you can go to manufactured goods, but we've been buying more manufactured goods than we've been producing and selling for quite a while. So that very obviously isn't the solution. About the only real solution to this is our great agricultural capacity. That's the only salvation.
Either that or cut out bringing in oil.
Yeah, that's very substantial, and it's increasing.
Well, could I make one more comment on this world food situation?
Yes.
And that relates back to the early 70s. We had this tremendous food reserve, surplus grain stored. We were wondering what to do with it. The reason that it all went in such a hurry was that the climate in parts of the world was very unfavorable for crop production. I think we had 2 years in some of the major population areas that food production was way down. That meant that, well, they were living right nip and tuck all the time. When they had those 2 bad years, their only hope was to get food from the exporting country, and the U.S. is a major one. In the last 2 years, those countries have had very favorable weather for crop production. So we're nip and tuck. We're just sort of unbalanced. There's going to be a year or two, maybe 2 or 3 years, several years, when there'll be surplus in the exporting country. The weather is going to change. We're going to go through the same thing again sometime in the future that we had in the early 70s. We're that nip and tuck.
I should also point out two important things relative to this, that still most of the grain in this country, the majority of it, is still going to feed livestock and not people. It's corn and wheat. When I was in Texas here a month or so ago, one of the largest feedlots in this country, in Texas, was feeding 60 to 70% wheat, substituting for roughage for these cattle because the roughage was more expensive than was the wheat. But I want to make that point that much of it is going for that. And when Russia imported all that, when they decided to buy all that wheat, you know, what was the decision they made? It wasn't to make a lot of bread for the Russians. But the Russians had to make a decision. And the decision was, should we cut down on the meat supply, the meat availability for the Russian people? And they decided not to, requiring this great shipment of wheat to feed their livestock.
Well,
A lot of it was for livestock feed.
And wasn't there all the fuss about some of them not being up to par? Remember they said that some of it was Belgium or whatever it was?
Yeah, the Russians complained some about that. The Chinese are the most, are among the most exacting and demanding as far as quality of the wheat goes, and we run into quite a bit of trouble there.
May I raise a question? You raised a question about India. Now, I don't have any idea if that's a significant amount according to our exporting in wheat. Of the tremendous waste, you said 50%, I think.
35 to 50%, yes.
Well, now, is this a problem of education? Because these people are going to have to be educated in some way that to eliminate this loss. Now, they're starving to death over there, but they still. What I'm trying to say, they won't cope with the problem yet, huh?
Not much of it is.
Who did this involve? Them or us?
Well,
I mean, as far as education.
We've tried, and some of our attempts have not been that successful. Initially, we went over there, and we built great big fertilizer plants, and got them conned into this. And then they applied fertilizer, and then the crops, they produced great big tall crops, and they pulled it over and rotted in the field because part of it was that they couldn't handle this kind of fertilizer applications. And so that they kind of lost some. We lost some stock on that, and of course it's a very big place, and we have the problem of not only ignorance but religion to deal with. You know, they're not too red hot for killing the rats, but it might be their grandmother, you know, reincarnated. That's for real. Right? They don't they're cattle. So that is a very serious problem, and part of it is just the capacity for transport. I mean, we can haul wheat over there, and then it rots in the bunkers they're put in, and it gets wet, and then they never get it moved out. Maybe the rolling stock is insufficient. Part of it is in just just the way they run the government. You think we got a lot of red tape and stuff, and buy-offs, you know, and racketeering and all. Boy, it's probably something to behold in some of these other places. So it's really a complex thing. It's a combination of things, and others may have more insight into this than I do. And their cattle, they do milk them, but they never kill them, and they're most of them are very poor, and they're overpopulation of livestock, so they're competing for a limited food source, so they don't give much milk. They're sort of skin and bone, and it's just, you know, if you're going to bet on something, you wouldn't bet on India right now. At one time, we had great plans for the nuclear development of the Indo-Gangetic Plain, which had great potential, because the Indo-Gangetic Plain has much greater potential for food production than the Great Valley of California. But it didn't really fully materialize. Now, for a time, you know, they weren't producing enough food. When the Green Revolution came in these shorter grains and the response to fertilizers appeared, India really became, for a very short time, an exporting nation. And things were looking out. Yeah, it really happened here. Yeah. But it was short-lived.
That is the result of the Green Revolution.
To an extent.
Temporary
access. Well, temporary to the extent that in order for this to be successful, of course, you have to have high input of fertilizers, and you've got to control the pests and all. And of course, with the increase in hydrocarbon fuel costs, it went out of sight, and they really couldn't afford to do what they were doing. Probably some failure also in maybe in the droughts or something. So it
Isn't it true that coexistence with that surplus, there were still people dying and now you've...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thousands dying all the time in Calcutta. You know, you can't stand to look at that very long. Well, except Mother Teresa can. And if you've never read the book, you should. It gives you some insight into this. You should read Mother Teresa. I guess it's called Something Beautiful for God by Malcolm Muggeridge. It's probably one of the more impressive books I've read in recent times.
A much better one, by the way, has recently come out on her, is Mother Teresa by Edmund Dillon, D-O-I-G. And it's just much better than Muggeridge.
Well, I won't quite buy that since I'm already, until I read it, because I'm very fond of Muggeridge. But I'll tell you when I read it.
You know, Neil, I think we have to think about other things that cattle give us, too, besides our food.
Very good point.
I think I read that it takes the pancreas of 23 cattle to produce enough insulin for one person a year. You know, a person with diabetes.
Well, a lot of drugs, the pituitaries, and it takes a lot to get that. So there are other resources in this that are very important.
How is the debate on this grain versus animal food situation going?
Well, no, you see, the plant people have by far the edge because on a cost-benefit analysis, for return for research and all, the grains come out of it. And they got a lobby that won't quit. And a lot of things, you look at animal, and the research there is very expensive. But you see, what I've been trying to work on is that they factor in, on for example, corn, whatever soil they're losing, and assign a cost to that soil. Huh? And I don't know if we can afford it in many areas.
You, as an animal man, didn't make those...
I'm prejudiced, of course.
You didn't make those figures up.
No. There's a very interesting study going on right now at National Academy of Sciences. And a friend of mine is chairman of this committee, looking at this issue. And
so that's scary to think of how much of the soil is...
Sure it is.
Well,
you want to address this? We have some soil experts here.
Where does the soil go? I know it's washed away, but where does it...
Down in... A lot of it down the river, of course.
Yeah, I know, but the river doesn't seem to get in shallower and things.
Oh, yeah, they're always dredging them, yeah. And down the mountain.
They're built up, and look, I guess.
Yeah.
And you talk about... thousands of tons per acre or section,
and
gosh, that's a lot of land, and that is all gone to the ocean.
Well,
a lot
of it's blowing.
There's a lot of it that goes down there, but some of these figures simply include erosion. Much of what is eroded goes down the lower part of the field.
Yeah,
well, that's one aspect of this erosion.
That makes your
oil
field more rich than
it. Yeah, it does. It's right. It's right. But a big part of that, still a tremendous amount, goes down the waterways and ends up in the ocean. And it's building up big numbers up. Many of them still on the other hand, don't serve.
With the normal erosion, can you build up your soil fast enough to take care of the erosion?
It all depends on how you look at it. Yeah. For example, the building that I'm in on the WSU campus, they cut down the hill, they cut off about 30 feet. Which was really subsoil. They worked it out, put in the chemicals, fertilizers, and so on, and planted them along, and it came as good as it did on my lawn when I planted on topsoil. But this now is using energy. You have to put in a lot greater input of...
Yeah.
It all depends on how expensive food is and what the excess availability of these resources are. These things are going to come into balance.
Well, they have different ways of preparing yourself, too. I don't know if they just attack your straw or something into the ground rather than plow over or something like that. I'm not a farmer, so I don't know.
Yeah, if you're talking
problem about tillage operations, there's a lot being done now to still maintain good production without the tillage resulting in so much erosion. A lot of that being done. And by the way, there is a federal law in effect now that says by 1983, we're going to have to implement all the best management practices we know how on the farmland to reduce erosion to the point where the surface waters are such that they'll meet the federal requirements. But there can be a range to be seen whether it'll really take place.
We're not in any immediate danger of lying hungry because of this immediate, I say, problem here in Northwest. In Science, or I forget which magazine it was recently, a lot of you may have seen it, I was somewhat startled to see what this means on a global scale, where they diagrammed the world's weather, not only Americas, but Africa and Europe and Asia, and the numbers that show there, the reclamation, you might say, where the desert had come back on them. They had reclaimed, in a lot of countries, they had reclaimed the areas of the desert at some cost. And then when these changes in cycles occurred, they also, incidentally, somewhat abused the land and overproduction. And then the slightest reverse brought it all back and it was all lost. And some of these people are almost entirely dependent upon that source for food. And the net loss, or the net gain of desert, I don't remember the number, it was quite startling.
Yeah, Sahara is moving south. I think it's the rate of about 2 miles a year, isn't it? Yeah, the other thing that I wanted to point out is that what Al has said is true, and you cut 30 feet off Palouse, but there's a lot of places where you can't cut 30 feet off. There's a lot of soil that isn't very deep. That's very important to realize. And the other thing is that in the recent survey by USDA, they thought that two-thirds of the cropland, or the tilled land of the United States, was needing was in need of serious consideration for improved conservation measures. Two-thirds.
What about your grain versus meat on amino acids?
The quality of the protein of the meat is generally better. There have been a few improvements in this to increase the amount of amino acids in some of the grains, which has been a very important breakthrough. But I think we better call it quits, and you'll see my comments tonight.